Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Joe at RT.ie. I think a lot of people are totally unaware of this. I was until we got a communication from Annette McKay, who's in Bury in Manchester, and Anna Corrigan is there as well. Annette, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
How are you?
I'm okay. A bit bewildered and, yeah. And very stressed.
When did you hear that somebody arrived at the site of the former Bon Secours home in Tuam, the mother and baby home, as it was called, and put up this big, is it a poster? It's a permanent kind of statement, isn't it, on the wall? They either nailed it to the wall or hammered. When did you become aware of this?
Somebody sent me a post from Facebook yesterday. And if you scan the pictures, I think I was sent 5 pictures.
Okay.
And it's the apology from the Bon Secours. It's Michael Higgins's apology. It's apology from the Archbishop. An apology from Galway County Council. So there's more than one.
Okay. And do we know who put them up?
No. So I, you know, the assumption was that somebody official has been and decided with no reference to the families groups that they were going to do this. I mean, it's just unconscionable that somebody, you know, would do this.
Now, the biggest one, it seems, is, and they're professionally printed and professionally erected.
Yeah,
absolutely.
They look like a corporate branding.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point. Yeah, it's the Bon Secours sisters statement. The Bon Secours sisters is, now it doesn't have the logo, I know, so we'll find out from the sisters if they had anything to do. But it is their statement, the commission's report.
Yeah.
Represent the history of our country in which many women and children were rejected, silenced and excluded, in which they were subjected to hardship and in which their inherent human dignity was disrespected in life and in death. Our sisters of Bon Secours were part of the sorrowful history, and they go on. Healing is not possible. I'm jumping to the end. Healing is not possible until what happened is acknowledged. Do you think it's wrong to pin that statement to the wall of where the children, near where the children are buried?
Do you know, Joe, I went to that site first thing in 2015 and somebody very gently pointed out to me that where I was stood possibly was the sewage tank, and therefore I was literally standing on the spot where my sister was. So my sister was underneath my feet in a sewage tank. It was like a punch to the stomach. And yesterday, to see that somebody had the insensitivity and lack of awareness to put posters when the children are still there, the babies are still in that tank. It doesn't matter how many apologies we have, there's been no movement from 2015 to 2021. Nobody has informed me, as you know, my mother's daughter, Mary Margaret's sister, this obscenity will end as soon as possible.
Okay.
It's an open-ended future for those children.
And I'll go on to Anna Corrigan now, but Annette, first of all, condolences about your sister. But Anna,
Thank you. Anna, your
point is that this wall and this sacred place, which has been properly marked through your work and the work of Catherine Corliss and many other groups as well, incredible work and a lot of times with a lot of church opposition. But your point is this wall near where the children are buried, where there's teddy bears now and flowers and little testimonies to the babies, this wall should not be used as an advertising corner, which is what it's become.
That's what it's become, Joe, because I'll tell you, way back 4 years ago, 4 years ago they wrote to a journalist, Saskia Webber, and they employed the services of Terry Prone. And they said, she said to Saskia was doing a documentary on Tuam,
French,
and she said, "Oh, let me explain when the Oh My God mass grave in the west of Ireland broke in an English-owned newspaper, it surprised the hell out everybody, not least the Bonsecours sisters of Ireland, none of whom ever worked in the tomb, like yourself, I'll parse it. It's come here. If you come here, you'll find no mass grave, no evidence that children were ever buried, and a local police force casting their eyes to heaven and saying, yeah, a few bones were found, but that area was where the famine victims were buried. So, I mean, to talk about insensitivity.
I think Terry Prone has apologised for that.
But she never apologised to me, or she never apologised to Chilean Baby's family. We have 11 of our members.
And was the letter dictated by the Bonsecours religious order?
I have no idea. It's a PR company. I mean, they say what they're told, I assume.
So how many... So the first one up on the wall, it looks like they're nailed to the wall. How would they stay on that wall? The first one, which is... I'm trying to give people a sense of the size of them. They're actually very, very big because they have to be read, so to speak, by somebody standing there looking at a wall. So,
very intrusive.
But they're about half a... Let me explain. They're about half a car parking space. Would that help people for each one? How many? We think there's five of them up on the wall.
There's four on the wall.
Okay. One is from Bonsecours. One is Galway County Council. One is Michael D. Higgins. And what's the fourth one? Do we know?
Archbishop Nearly, who lives a kilometre up the road.
Okay.
I mean, they're talking about acknowledgement. They still haven't acknowledged what they did to my two brothers. And they haven't answered any questions from the police. So, like, this is 8 years I've been waiting, right? Mm-hmm. And I have the Chilean Babies family group.
Yeah, I know.
And we have 11 of our family members in that pit. And all we're doing is waiting and waiting. We're being turned inside out. We're being run around in circles. We had an excavation, an exhumation. Mm. They took the body parts out for carbon dating. They released a report by the expert technical group. Then they handed the land back to the Galway County Council, who came and backfilled it and put grass again over the septic tank. And now we need a new law to come in and open it up again. And we're supposed to be satisfied with apologies while we wait. And as Annette says, my brother lying there rotting in a sewerage pit. We haven't got answers.
We've just got a statement in from Galway County Council. And Galway County Council have been made aware this morning, I think it was by us, through your good selves who told us about it. Galway County Council have been aware this morning that signage has been erected at the site of the former Tuam mother and baby home. This signage was not erected with the consent of the council, and the council was not consulted and had no knowledge of the proposal to erect the signage or who took this course of action. The council is aware of the upset caused by the signage and accordingly have made arrangements for its removal. The council is fully committed to supporting the full range of actions agreed by government in relation to the tomb site, including appropriate memorialisation. It is essential that all actions taken in relation to this site are on the basis of open and transparent consultation. Now, the question is, who paid for these and who paid for their erection?
Sorry, Joe, you're talking about memorialisation.
Okay.
We've never been told about memorialisation. We have been promised excavation, exhumation, DNA, identification. We need all the files that pertains to the children, why they're in there, and are they actually in there, Joe? Or are they illegally adopted? As Fergus Findlay from the Bernardo said, that he was aware, not in relation to Tuam, but that death certs were falsified to broker adoption. So we need answers.
Joe, can I
just say that when this story broke, my mother was still alive.
Okay.
And, you know, she was ill, but nobody knocked on my mother's door to apologise or explain how her baby ended up in a sewage tank. Mm. And apologies come at the end of a long process. So redress, reparation, investigation, identification, even for us, the fact that the site is still as it was 5 years ago and somebody to come along. And now, as you say, we don't know who did this. It's insulting. Mm. It's inhuman.
Did anyone know? So, we'll ask now, Annette. Did anyone see? It would have taken a good hour to put them up, at least.
Yeah.
Does anyone know who printed them? Who produced them? They are a professional production. Does anyone know who erected them? Does anyone know who paid for them?
Nobody's admitting to it, are they?
So far. Well, a lot of people were unaware of it until, as I say, yourself and Anna through the Tuam Family Support Group alerted people, including ourselves. And you see, isn't part of it now, we cannot attribute any responsibility to who put it up. We don't know. But is it not fair to say, if I came along there as a stranger, I would read it and I would say, well, that's very good of the Bon Secours sisters to put up that. Now, it was a statement that was a long time in coming, and it was a statement when the Mother and Baby Home report came out about 12 weeks ago. Even Catherine Corliss was gobsmacked by it. It was so strong because all the previous statements, as you say, had been so ambivalent, if not dismissive. So would somebody coming along saying, God, that's very good of the order to come up with such a heartfelt statement talking about we were part of the problem and we feel the guilt. Now, that doesn't mean that the Bon Secours order put up or paid for the advertising corner, as Anna so aptly called it. I don't know.
But it doesn't take away from the fact that you only have to look down at your feet and see that the septic tank is still the septic tank. Nobody's put posters up at the end of a long process and said, this used to be a place where children had been buried in a sewage tank. And these are the apologies that followed a very long process. While, as Anna says, we are still waiting for the removal, the DNA identification, and Mary Margaret to return to my mother. I might want to visit Tuam years from now and tell my children and my grandchildren about what happened to Granny. I certainly wouldn't take my family to look at apologies while our family member is still lying beneath our feet.
Okay, well, maybe I'd say, now, if there's anyone in the Tuam area that's listening, even if you're in your car, would you drive around or walk around or cycle around and maybe talk to us about how the posters are attached to the wall? Is there any, most posters, especially I'm thinking of election posters, they always put at the corner erected by and printed by. Is there any identification or any clearer images available if anyone is in the Tuam area? Anna or Annette, to begin with, I know you're in Manchester, Annette, but if you were in Tuam, what would you do if you walked around and found those posters on the wall?
Well, if it wasn't for COVID, Joe, I'd be there this morning with a flamethrower and I would be taking the posters down myself. They're an insult. And in Germany, it's actually illegal to erect any posters without permission of affected families and survivors, because people recognise that it's very, very offensive. This is not a place to advertise your good intentions. We need to see physically what your good intentions are or will be. We are still haggling. The Bon Secours are still haggling about the price of the exhumation. They promised $2.5 million. Their order is worth $10 billion. They're haggling for $2.5 million. The exhumation cost, we were told 2 years ago by Catherine Zappone, would be $11 million. I don't see why Irish people, taxpayers, should have to pay the cost of this. They didn't put those babies in that sewage tank. The Bon Secours did. And their apology, therefore, is meaningless until they're willing to follow it up with action and stop haggling about the cost.
Okay,
we're not taking your last penny.
I take they are bigger issues. But if you look at the posters just as they are they not just communicating to people who would arrive that there have been apologies after a long battle, but there have been apologies?
Apologies are meaningless, Joe. Okay. They have to come. It's a human rights abuse that's happened at Durham and the other places.
Okay, I take that. But that's a bigger issue, isn't it? Let me go.
But thankfully, Maureen from the Cork Survivors Group, she was on the phone at 9 o'clock this morning, you know, trying to speak to councillors. You know, the island is dotted, as we know, with these mother and baby homes and, you know, 12 homes, 9,000
And I know, and the memorial, how to memorialise and how to mark them is very, very sensitive.
No, it is.
Yeah, okay, stay with us. Catherine Corliss is there, campaigner Catherine Corliss. Catherine, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
Good. You're saying, well, you tell us what your knowledge of the posters are.
Well, I was made aware of those about 3 weeks ago, and they asked my opinion, and I said, look, whatever goes out there for the Tuam babies, whatever highlights the Tuam babies, I will support it.
Okay.
Now, it was a very innocent move on behalf of a few very nice Tuam people who got together and put those up there and paid for them themselves.
Okay.
And I couldn't see a thing wrong with it, to be honest with you, Joe.
And what was their, when they approached you and broached it with you, what was their intent, Catherine?
Their intent, like everything else, as people are aware, there are vigils for the Tuam babies.
Yeah.
The people come and they bring flowers. People come and they hang up. Even last St. Valentine's Day, a woman in Galway went to the trouble of asking people to knit little hearts that she could string together to string up for the babies. It's all for awareness. Every time something happens in Tuam, it brings the Tuam babies to the fore. And I know Annette and I know Anna, and I'm so sorry that they've taken this angle. There was absolutely no intention of offence. It was highlight, bring us out there. Because, as we said, we are so disappointed in the final report from the Commission of Inquiry. It really put everyone on just on a real low. And I mean to say, anything that will highlight the Tuam babies and bring it into the face. The whole idea is for the Bon Secours. I actually put that up on Facebook myself, because we don't know whether the Bon Secours are going to contribute any more or not. I totally agree with Annette McKay that, yes, the Bon Secours should cover the lot. And this was a little effort to for awareness, Joe. That's all it is.
And should they, Catherine, should somebody have indicated on the posters, because they're very nicely and professionally produced.
They are.
Should they have indicated who they were erected by? Would that have helped the confusion?
Would it have helped in this? I don't know. Well, I mean, surely to goodness, if it was the Bon Secours, they would have their logo up. If it was the Galway County Council, they would have their logo up. I'm just after coming from the site now, Joe, I've just been in there. And there's a man waiting from Galway County Council, unfortunately, to take them down.
Okay.
And there was a few journalists there. And then again, I think that's good. It's highlighted again. It's telling the government and the Bon Secours, we're not gone away. We're waiting. We're waiting for something to happen. We acknowledge the apologies, but they're no good in their own. I agree with Annette on that. And we really need action. And hopefully... Mm-hmm. We will be attending the Oireachtas next month, a group of us from Tuam and other areas. We have to stand in front of the Oireachtas and tell them why the babies have to be exhumed from the site. And that's unfortunate, but that's what we have to do. That's the struggle we have, Joe. And that's the only reason for that.
Okay. And then,
Catherine, can I just say,
that's
Catherine,
Annette, yeah.
I really appreciate people had good intentions. But if people had asked myself or Anna or any of the families, I'm sure we would have been able to explain why we felt so strongly about those apologies going up there, and the fact that, you know, the timing was wrong. I really do appreciate, and the hearts and the vigils, people have been so supportive and very kind, and, you know, we feel supported by all that support. But I think a phone call for somebody to say, we've got this idea, what do you think about it? That would have really helped us. But it was such a shock because, as you know, under human rights legislation and process, the apologies come at the end of an action. And we're nowhere near ready for that action. And I agree with you. I'm so grateful that you speak out and you're still there, that we need to push to get those children out of there. It's just unfortunate that, you know, it's happened, and it's miscommunication, but they need to come down, Catherine. They really do.
Okay, yeah. Well, they're being taken down at the moment anyway.
And Joe, can I come in there?
Yeah, Anna, yes.
Yeah, you must remember these apologies, while they're hanging on a wall, were never conveyed in person to any survivor or any family member. Hmm. We read these in the newspaper. They were never called in as a group to kind of do a face on and to actually be told, we are so, so sorry what happened. We've been battling this forever, right? Yeah. Now, I must also say, you mentioned memorialisation. That's we are not having any memorialisation. We are having excavation, exhumation and DNA. And as Catherine said about the law, here is the idiocy of it. They used Section 28 of the Commissions Act to open it initially. Mm-hmm. They started an excavation, an exhumation, and they took body parts out for carbon dating and possible DNA. Then they covered it up again. They handed the land back to the Galway County Council, handed stewardship of Stium over to the mother, over to the Department of Youth and Children, and now we need a law to open it again. I mean, how much can we take? And the road to heaven is paved with good intentions.
Yeah. You see,
this law is another fiasco. I'm going in with our barrister to speak to it. And all they want to do is put Hume to bed and ensure that nobody else will get justice for the other 9,000 children. I've read the law 6 times. Our barrister has sent a 78-page submission in, and this is a fiasco. Take the children out. Do what's right. Under human rights, we have our rights. Our family have rights. They may have been abrogated. They may have been destroyed and taken away, but they will not happen now. And I have met the people in Tuam, and I have the height of respect for them. They supported us along the way, but this does not involve these apologies. They can't tell me face to face.
But Anna, do you accept, which I think you do from what you're saying, that what Catherine is saying, these were some local people in Tuam who were trying to, with good intent, trying to show their empathy, sympathy or whatever, that it was with good intent. Now, I know the council were going to take them down anyway because they did no permission. Because I'm very conscious that Catherine lives in Tuam, and over the years when she raised it, she wasn't always well received, including by the local clergy and hierarchy. So it's been a difficult, and Catherine, does that explain some of it, that there's some people in Tuam felt that we needed to make a statement saying that we are fully in support of the women, primarily, who are campaigning on this issue?
Well, absolutely, Joe. That's the whole point of it, that people are desperately trying to do something to, you know, to keep this alive, and they're helpless as regards the government and what's going to happen. And it's just they're doing their little bit, as I said, like bringing in little gifts and bringing highlight and having the visions all that. It's just they're trying to do something, and it wasn't meant. There wasn't no disrespect meant whatsoever. Okay, just to get that message to Anna.
Just one last thing.
Anna, yeah.
I would have preferred if they put up posters saying, "Exhume the children. How long more do we have to wait? It's a travesty of justice. Where are their human rights?" I would have loved 4 posters with that up.
Okay. Well, I know, and as you know, and you've all been so eloquent and vocal on it. Catherine, yourself, Anna, Annette, and other campaigners as well have been from day one of that mother and baby home report saying there has to be a law brought in immediately. No diddy-dallying over the exhumation. Okay, Annette McKay, hopefully that clarifies it. But Catherine, you're saying that the council...
I really want Catherine to get the message that we really, really do appreciate the support from the people of Tuam. They've been nothing but kind and supportive and welcoming. When we have that meeting with Minister Zappone, the room in the Coralie was absolutely filled with local people who wanted to stand with us and support us. I've got nothing but respect and admiration for Catherine and people in Tuam.
Okay, well said, well said. Okay, Annette McKay, Anna Corrigan. Catherine, how are you at the minute? Is there a session in the Dáil soon, or a committee in the Dáil going to talk about changing the law, or have they advanced on it at all? Do you know?
Well, all we know is we're waiting to meet with the Oireachtas who are at the moment deciding, putting their ideas together whether to pass this bill or not. We will be meeting them, and I know Anna will as well, in April the 14th, we will actually be meeting with the Oireachtas team, and it's our chance again to give a final plea, just get this done. And you see, Mr. O'Gorman, Roderick O'Gorman, said that it might be the end of the year before the bill is passed. We're objecting to that. They can pass it within the next month if they really want to, and that is our hope at the moment.
Okay. Annette McKay, Anna Corrigan, thanks for contacting us, and Catherine Corliss for clarifying that as well. I presume, insofar as you know, will the council are removing them as we speak, but they're not going to destroy them, are they? I presume they're going to give them back to whoever.
There was a message to one of the group there from the CEO of Galway County Council to say that they will hold on to the placards. Or the boards, whatever you call them, and that they will hold on to them, and maybe at a future date, we'll be able to put them up somewhere else.
Okay. Thanks indeed, Annette, Anna, and Catherine Corliss. 51551, my chance. Joe at rte.ie is a simple email, and 1850 715 815.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
I mentioned if there's anyone knew anything else about the posters that have gone up, let us know. Denise Gormley has contacted us. Denise, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Good, thanks. You were part of the group who put the posters up.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, tell us how it came about, Denise.
Do you want the long version or the short version?
I want the Denise version. I don't mind. Tell us.
Well, I'm a PhD candidate in the Irish Centre for Human Rights. I'm absolutely horrified by this whole saga and the fact that there's hundreds of babies' bodies in a sewage system in Tuam. When I was in 1996, I was out in Kenya, and a truckload of Kenyans crashed into a truckload of Sudanese, and I was asked to assist in burying the bodies in a mass grave. I wasn't qualified to do. I was only 17 at the time.
Okay.
To bury the bodies in a mass grave, and I thought to myself the indignity of the process, and I said, thank God I'm not from a country where this kind of thing happens. Little did I realise I had spent the previous 8 years in a school 2 kilometres away from the site of a mass grave of babies' bodies which are now lying in the sewage system. I don't understand for the life of me how this is still ongoing. So I have been involved. When Catherine Zappone came down to do the public consultation, the final public consultation in Tuam, I had never heard of any other consultations.
Okay.
And I heard the narrative that the people of Tuam were divided as to what should happen. I said, there's nobody that's in their right mind that could put their hand up and say that hundreds of babies' bodies should be left in the sewage system. I went door to door asking people how they felt and whether they agree with the survivors as to whether these babies should be taken out. Every single door I went to, one elderly gentleman came out and said he had no interest in any of those issues. But every single door I went to, everybody agreed that the family members should have their relatives returned to them and that it's a disgrace what's happened. So I've since been door to door in Tuam, and I cannot believe that there is people in Tuam that do not know these apologies were issued, that don't know the content of the apologies. There's people in Tuam that don't know where the site is located, and there's even people in Tuam that have never heard of the mother and baby home. So that is why these posters were put up. I've been involved in a group called As Long As I Can See the Light, who've been campaigning with silent vigils and candlelights and lights up. And it's just, as a legal scholar, I can appreciate the weight of the written word. Every single comma in those statements has significance. Every single word that's there. So this is purely information. It was not put up by the nuns. It was put up by the people of Tuam who have been campaigning for years.
And the group is called, the group who put them up is called As Long As I Can See the Light.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. And you paid for them and...
Yeah.
And you picked 4 apologies. Bonsecour, Uachtaráin na hÉireann,
Archbishop Neary,
and the council one,
and Michael D. Higgins.
And they're gone now.
They're not gone, no, because there's an awful lot of people here down at the site.
Oh,
there's media down here, and I think I don't know their exact reasons, but they're not taking them down yet. There's a lot of people here, and there's a lot of conversations happening. So I understand to an extent of why people might, if they thought it was the nuns that put them up, that they might, that they would.
Would it have been helpful, Denise, to put up to include on them, which are very professionally produced and nicely designed, that to put up at the bottom, erected by As Long As I Can See the Light, a tune group in support of the families and survivors of the mother and baby home.
Yeah.
But that's not on it. That's not on
it. It's not. No.
And you raise money yourselves to pay for them and put them up.
The group members paid for the signs to be produced and put up. So,
you did it because your intent was just to try and educate, remind, reiterate people what was there and to people, especially those who didn't know about it. Okay.
I suppose, you see, the people that are involved in all these groups on social media are very aware of what's going on, but there's so many people in Tuam that are not linked into these and have no idea, and I can't believe the amount of people that have said to me they hadn't heard the apologies that were given and they hadn't heard the content of it. From my own perspective, that was the reason behind. And as I said, as a legal scholar, you don't have any action before you have to have the words first, and the action follows. And there'll be many more words written before these babies are taken out, but they will be written. And I think these statements are the start of that process.
Now the council said they are taking them down, so there's no debate.
They did, yeah.
There's no debate about that.
That they said that because of the amount of complaints that have come in.
But I'm kind of curious as to why
they react so quickly now.
I take your point. But are you taken aback by the complaints, or you now understand them a little bit?
I'm kind of confused as to why somebody said the nuns put it up and then everybody believed that the nuns came down and put them up. I'm confused as to why people would think that they would do that.
I suppose because it was the photograph we got was the Bon Secours sister's statement. Though I did say earlier on, I had no logo or no, so there was no indication that it was from the sisters. But that's as it is at the minute. If you can stand out of the wind a bit, Denise.
I can. Yeah.
Are you cast down then by the reaction, Denise?
I can kind of understand it to an extent that, you know, if it was erected by the nuns, I can kind of understand it. But I suppose I am confused as to why so many people believed that it was the nuns that put it up. I mean, it's not pleasant reading. It's
even on the day that the apology came. When the mother and baby home report came out, people were taken aback, given their previous dissembling apologies, I suppose, is the best. Annette McKay is still there from Manchester. Annette, does that explain it a bit more?
Hello, Joe. Hello, Denise.
I'm
really pleased. I'm good. And I'm glad we've got this opportunity to speak, because I really now I understand that people had very, very good intentions. And, you know, I bow to nobody in my respect for the people of Tuam and the support we've always had there. But I do really wish that you know, people would see and understand why we're so upset that, you know, we're not at the end of this process. Okay. And if those posters had been put in Tuam Town Hall and people could go to the town hall and have that discussion, it would have literally taken the heat away from Tuam.
Okay.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I suppose we had smaller versions with cable ties. They have been there quite a while with the apologies, but I suppose with the weather and everything, they were being destroyed. Yeah. So I suppose it's just in bigger print and
more permanent, you thought.
Yeah, it's not a niche shrine, it's not a grotto. It's basically just putting the information up there. You know, and
from a legal perspective.
But you see, the
words
the problem
are the most important.
The problem is, Denise, for us always is that the apologies, if they had come at the end of a physical process where the babies had been taken away and identified and exhumed, then it would literally have some meaning. But because we are still, those posters are around the site where the babies still are. So it's really difficult for us to understand that we have to look at apologies when nothing has happened.
Okay. Denise, what I would say to you, Annette, you can check me if I'm wrong. And Denise, I would say make sure, the councillor is saying the posters are coming down, they will take them down. Ask them to try and take them down without damaging them, and then someone store them safely indoors, because as Annette says, there is a time and a place for them to be used again. So that might help. Please don't let anyone destroy them or throw them in the back of a transit van and never to be seen again. Hold on to them, store them.
And I do want to apologise for my remark about the flamethrower. That was just overreaction.
Okay.
But I do, you know, really, really wish we could meet and we understand where we're coming from.
Okay. Annette McKay, thanks indeed. Denise, any other plans for any, like, I know Catherine, well, I hope Catherine, the last time I was talking to her, she was writing a memoir.
I know there's a group that are planning to camp out at the site, and like I'm so disgusted and so ashamed to be Irish. I'm willing to go on hunger strike, and I have told that to the minister. I'll go on hunger strike if these babies are left any longer, because I don't understand how we're supposed to live in this town. As somebody from UN Women said to me, if this was in a developing country, how much more attention it would have got on the media. I can't for the life of me understand why we're still here asking for hundreds
for
of babies' bodies to be taken out of the sewage system.
Well, it's good that we've been reminded of that in itself. Denise Gormley, you heard what Annette said. You heard the generous tone of Anna and Annette. So please take heart from that. Don't be cast down. These things happen. And as I say, make sure somebody holds on and looks after the posters. And best of luck with your ongoing campaign, Denise and the people in Tuam. And to Annette
Hopefully
McKay.
Not ongoing for too much longer, Joe.
Yeah, good point. Well made. Well checked. Well made. Good Amila Mahoga. Thanks, Denise. Thanks, Annette McKay. Joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Andrew Moore is with FlyFit. Andrew contacted us a number of days ago. The Gardaí arrived this morning, did they, Andrew, and brought the women back up to the spot, is it?
Hello, Joe, can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear.
So what happened actually was, it was actually last week when I was talking to the young girl in question, and she had contacted the Gardaí, and the Gardaí had brought her over to the spot where this nasty incident happened in Dublin.
Okay, tell us, was in Port Marnock, what happened? Insofar as I'm conscious that there's children listening as well, but tell us as best you can what happened and why it was so deeply upsetting and worrying for the women involved.
So what happened was, last Friday, I have a running client of mine who does running during the week. Mm-hmm. And at 4 p.m, I went to my phone, I looked at my phone, and I noticed I received about 6 or 7 messages from this girl. And she just told me that she'd been out in a run, where she had to go back and forth on the same stretch of road in the daytime, roughly around 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And before she was even telling me the story, she was really apologizing for failing to finish her run, which was surprising. And then she went on to tell me that when she was going from one of the sections where she had put down cones to decide where she was going to stop on the end of her interval run, she had came across a man doing a very intimate thing in a very intimate area in public during the day by the roadside. And because of this, she got up, she ran off and ran back home, left her cones there and decided to let me know and then report it to the Gardaí.
Okay. So the man was performing this act on himself in knowing that this woman involved would be able to see him when she came around that corner or whatever.
That was
the so-called gratification, that he did it in public in front of a woman.
Yes, because she had planned, she was doing a workout where she was going from one location back and forth. So it was obvious that she was going to returning back to the same area. And it was,
Now, Annie, have there been any other sightings of this man?
So after this incident has happened, she was then going to work the following day with a colleague of hers. And before she fully described the details of the colleague, a colleague has kind of said, oh, is it this person? Is this person with this information? Okay. And she says, yep,
that area or green or park, has it got a name in Port Marnock? What's it known as, Andrew?
Actually, unfortunately, when I looked online to find the map, I couldn't see a name. But it's the park which is right opposite the Statoil station. And I think it's in the corner of Coast Road and Strand Road opposite Statoil.
Okay. Stay there, Andrew, because Mary contacted as well, but it's a different park we're talking about. What happened, Mary?
Oh, hi. How you, Joe? How's it going?
Good, thanks.
So normally I meet a friend here in one of the local parks. Mm-hmm. It's not Port Marnock now, it's up Clon Griffin.
So
I normally meet her there on a Wednesday, but this is going back now 2 weeks ago, it's the 5th of March, but couldn't make it that Wednesday, so we ended up meeting on the Friday evening. Anyhow, went down to the park and we started our run, as you do in the actual park. And it was coming, it was after 5 o'clock, whatever, and the man was going around ringing the bell to let people know that the gates were being closed.
Okay.
So anyhow, myself, my friend running around, we finished our 5K.
I didn't know that. Someone goes around with a bell.
Yes, just to let people know that they're that he's closing the gates.
Well, like a school, our old school bells.
Yes.
Okay, so someone goes around with a bell. And what happens if I'm locked in the
old
park?
Old school. Well, you see, this is the issue, because this is what I'm going to talk about now. So we finished the run anyhow, and we came to the gate.
Yeah.
But myself and my friend were well fit and healthy, well able to climb over gates.
Oh, the gates were locked. Okay.
Yes. Now, they're not very high gates. They're only about like four feet or something.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so we came to the gate and we noticed it was locked. And there was a group of young lads, two girls with them as well, about six or eight of them, just across from us.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, I started to climb over the gate, and then with that, just started getting abuse hurled at us from like these kids no older than 10.
Yeah.
Now, the abuse was coming like probably what little kids normally do. I hope you fall, blah, blah, blah. But that was okay. But then as I climbed over the other side of the gate, they started shouting obscenities.
Okay.
I don't actually really want to say it.
Yeah, okay.
What he actually, repeat what he said, but yeah, it was disgusting. So I just seen red at that stage, so I just threw a bit of abuse back. I was just like, oh my God, the smell of you. So anyhow, myself and my friend then continued on doing our stretches just down from the gate outside the park at this stage. And with that then, one of the lads, I swear no older than 10, came over and started throwing a bottle of orange over me.
Mm-hmm.
Got my hair, my face and my top and everything, whatever, that was grand.
Okay.
But yeah, exactly.
You're 10. Like, sorry, he's 10.
Yeah. He's 10, yeah.
And he's throwing, I don't know what age you are, but he's throwing a bottle of Fanta from your voice. He's throwing a bottle of Fanta over someone who could be the same age as his mother.
Yes, I'm in my 40s. Yes, this is the thing. This is what shocked me. I couldn't get over. I was like, oh my God, what is happening here? From a little, like, 10-year-old. So I was just, I shouted again at him, but he walked back over to the group and he started, this one lad in particular, I remember a blue top on him, he started pulling out of a tree then. And what actually really caught my attention, what I really observed, was how there was people walking by in the park. This man then was walking past and actually went over and told him off.
Yeah, fair play.
I noticed the reaction, but the reaction, there was no reaction from the guy to the male. Which I thought, oh, that's strange. He's over here throwing orange over a woman, but not like no abuse back to a man. Anyhow, that was grand. Then myself and my friend continued on doing the stretches. And then a couple of minutes later, my friend just was like, oh my God, here they are. They're coming out over the gate now. Now, this is a group of little 10-year-olds, I swear to God.
Yeah.
So we're standing there. And my car was nearby, but to be honest, I was actually afraid to get into my car, thinking what they'd come over and do. Anyhow, in the commotion of it all, of them getting over the gate, the one lad in particular, again with the blue top on, he kind of fell out onto the road and a taxi man had to slam on his brakes because he nearly fell into him. But the same little 10-year-old actually turned around to the male driver in the taxi and actually was apologetic, actually was like, sorry, mate. Now, that again really rang bells with me. I was like, here he is attacking women, throwing stuff over women, but to male, it's completely different.
And would you go back to that park, Mary?
So I haven't been back in the evening time. We went back. We went out there on Paddy's morning for a run at 9 o'clock. Because to be honest, I would be a bit afraid. Because after that, after he nearly fell into the taxi, then he actually came back with the rest of the bottle and threw the rest of the bottle over myself, and he got my friend this time as well. So I just stood there. We just stood there, and I was like, "Oh my God, I can't believe this is happening." The age of them, at 10 years of age, such misogynistic behaviour towards women.
In a gang. And then that, in a gang.
Yes. And this was the whole time, actually, that same week that what happened to that poor girl Sarah over in London.
So
it really just it's highlighting actually, like at that age, I swear they were no older than 10. At that age, behaving like that, no fear, no respect for women. And actually, as they actually were running off down the street, I shouted at them, go home and learn respect and learn to be kind. It's highlighting this, like it's...
And when there's a group around, what you say, there were 7, 8, 9 of them, but many...
There was about 6 to 8 of them, and there were two girls with them. Now, the girls just walked past with no bother with the girls. But
six to eight lads in the group. I know you're saying they're only 10, but they still are. Yeah. They can be intimidating.
Oh, totally.
Because you don't know what they're going to do.
Yes.
You can't do anything. You can't.
Exactly.
You can't drive off. You're afraid you might hit one, and one that might kick you, or whatever. And if they throw a bottle of Fanta over you, they can.
Yeah.
Anyway.
What would they be capable of?
Okay.
But it's just, and I hadn't had my phone on me. Had I had my phone on me, I would have rang the guards.
But
I just wanted to highlight that. It's just, like, I think the whole thing, education...
A fair play to that man who checked them.
But to be honest, Joe, I think it really needs to start at a young age education in schools. Yeah. Learned to respect, how to respect, and then how to check in with our own emotions as well. Because obviously that young lad with the blue top on, he obviously has major anger issues.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're taught in school how to tap into that and deal with them, like, constructively and stuff, you know, you wouldn't be going around behaving like that maybe, or disrespecting people, especially women.
And you see, the worry is, Mary, as you know, a lot of that age group, well, they're back now. If they're, 10, they're in, fifth class, maybe? Fourth, fifth. They're back in school, but they've been off school for all summer.
Yeah.
In other words, 10 weeks from the lockdown is a summer holiday again.
Yeah.
And you just wonder what they've been doing. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
Shocking.
Okay. Mary, look after yourself. Keep exercising. Yeah. And thanks indeed. That's Mary and Andrew Moore from FlyFit in Portmarnock. Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
If it's Friday and if it's live line, there must be a love story. By the way, this day last week was Eileen from Castle Island in Kerry. Wasn't remember the driver, the drover and the cattle dealer. And the cattle dealer was the difficult one, and the driver took a fancy to Eileen. He was only 25, 1963. They were absolutely head over heels in love. The cattle dealer wasn't happy with this because he had, to use that old phrase, he had a soft spot for Eileen as well, but Eileen only had eyes for the driver. And then the cattle dealer, who was the driver's boss, said, oh, by the way, bit of bad news, Eileen, the poor driver's been killed, he crashed my truck and is dead. And Eileen went on with her life and met another man, and was set to get married. And 2 days before she got married, who did she meet as they drove along the road around Tralee and Killarney, but the dead driver, so to speak. And they renewed their acquaintance and pledges, but it was too late. Eileen had already committed to marrying the man that she married and was happily married to for 45 years. And as she said herself, I would have walked up the aisle 2 days later with one on each arm. I was in love with the two of them, equally torn between two lovers. Now, we haven't managed to find definitively the driver or the dealer. But we've had so many contacts, and we passed them on to Eileen. Now, a number of them have been around an individual who is now deceased, unfortunately. And what we've done is there were photographs of the individual on rip.ie, and listeners to the programme sent us in those photographs. And we've passed them on to Eileen to see kind of jog her memory. It was 1963, but as you heard last week, she's still very much involved. So we'll keep you up to date every Friday from here to eternity until we get an answer. Now, Emer Doyle Guzman contacted us on light of that story. The year is 1976, Emer.
Hi, Joe. How are you? Good afternoon.
Emer is what age in 1976?
Emer in 1976 was 16.
And what happened, Emer, 16-year-old Emer, in 1976?
Well, what happened was we had a Mexican student staying with us for a year. She came to school, came over to Ireland to go to school, learn English.
Okay.
And the funny thing about it, though, Joe, is that she wasn't even supposed to stay with us. My mother used to keep students in the summer. Right. But not for the school year. And that particular year, our neighbour, she was just gone and lived in with our neighbour, and something happened. And our neighbour, there was an emergency, and she asked Mum, could Mabel come and stay with us? So that was the start of it. Then she stayed with us for the whole year. And her parents invited me to go back to Mexico for the summer.
All right.
So this was, again, Mabel, well, that was 1975 to 76, and then I went over to Mexico for 6 weeks. And my first day there, my second day there, I met this guy.
Yeah.
He was 21 and most gorgeous brown eyes I'd ever seen. And okay. I was completely smitten. But I was 16.
Yes, yes.
So I went out once. He asked me out once. And and then that was it. And I came back.
Okay.
So we fast forward to 1979. And he was over in Brighton learning English.
Okay.
And he asked, could he come and see me? So I said, yeah, Grant, come over. It'd be nice to meet up again. And I had an Irish boyfriend at the time.
Ah, complications, yeah. Yes.
Complications.
Here we go again.
So here we go. So the three of us wandered around Dublin. And honest to God, it was...
Oh, your boyfriend came with you?
Well, yeah, because at that point, like, I mean, 3 years had gone by. I was a mature girl now of 19. And I thought, ah, sure, what? You know, he just wants to know me as a friend.
Yeah, yeah.
So the three of us wandered around Dublin to all the sights. And, oh, gosh, it was weird and bizarre. And anyway, so... Jesus eventually, he had to go back.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember the day he left, I was in bits. I went to see him off at the ferry, and I was in bits after it. And I remember thinking, what is wrong with you? Because, you know, I had a few boyfriends, and I had this other lad, and I was, you know, and I was in a bad way. So I broke it off with the other fella. And then
The Irish chap.
Oh,
okay.
And then discreetly let Jesus know that
Jesus
was all off.
Okay.
Now, this was all letters.
Yes,
because back in the day, there was no email. You know, there was nothing. So then in the summer of 1980, he came back. And that's when we got together. And we decided, right, what are we going to do now? So we decided we wanted to get married, and we were going to give each other 6 months to think about it. And if I still wanted to marry him in... at Christmas of 1980, I was going to go over and meet his family. And I had all these plans, you know, and I said, oh, that's grand. So I it was a long 6 months, Joe. We spent a small fortune on phone calls, like your other previous caller. I mean, you know, now we had a phone at home, but my father went ballistic with the phone bills, as you can imagine.
And what did your father or mother think of this Mexican chap, who I presume they had not met previously, landing at your hall door, and he's...
Yeah. No, they hadn't met him. When he came over the very first time, he came out to the house one evening. He was staying in Black Rock.
Mm-hmm.
He called up to the house and he knocked on the door. And you know, he'd big brown eyes, he'd jet black hair, he'd a beard and a long navy blue trench coat.
Okay.
And he knocked on the door and he said to my father, Dad opened the door and he says, how are you? He says, I am Jesus. I've come for Emer. And my father says, you what? And he goes, what? And he says, Emer, for God's sake, there's some fella here claims to be Jesus and come to get you. So
he's
anyway,
standing there with his beard and his hair and his deep brown eyes and his long robe. And he says, he knocks on the door, your father opens and says, hello, I'm Jesus, I've come for Emer.
Yeah, just like that. And again, he's pidgin English and he decided instead of saying Jesus, which is in Spanish, and that doesn't sound the same for us.
Yeah,
as it does, but he gave him the full English translation of his name, you know.
Right.
So my parents didn't really take it very seriously to start with. Mm-hmm. And then when I went over Christmas, they were going, okay. So I went over, I met his family, they were fabulous. And I had a great time and I came back. And then I started talking to my parents seriously. And they still didn't really take it seriously. And then one day my mother started talking to me about my 21st, which was coming up in May. Okay. This probably was the middle of February. And I said, look, I'm not interested in a party. I couldn't care less. Hmm. If you want to have Tommy apart, Tommy apart. I'm not interested. If he's not here, there's no point.
You were a bit lovesick for Hazel.
Very. Hazel. Yes, okay. I was. I was a bit lovesick. So she said to me, I remember saying to me, so you're serious? I said, well, yeah, I've been trying to tell you that for the last 6 months. And I said, Mum, I'm 20 years old. I know what I'm doing. Imagine, Joe. You have kids of your own. 20, you know nothing. But yeah. I sort of did, though, really, you know.
Okay.
So she said, all right, so let me talk to your dad. So that's what happened. Then we got married. It was weird because I was then going around with my mother. To all the different venues to have the invitations printed up. And I think it was a means to an end, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I was happy out, and we went, for instance, to get because remember back in the day, when you had anything like a wedding invitation, you had to go into the printer and you had to give the name, you know, and pick out the design.
But at that stage, Eimear, how many times had yourself and Hazel met each other and been with each other, so to speak?
Well, I think we'd been a couple of weeks here and a couple of weeks there, Joe.
Say language?
Spanish. I hadn't a word of Spanish at the time, but he had good enough English.
Okay.
But there was things. I mean, it wasn't easy.
And so you got married in around your 24th birthday.
Yeah, on the 2 days after, because my 21st was a Saturday, and it was too late to book anything in March for May, you know. And of course, my mother was. We went to have the invitations printed, for instance. I know in Mexico and Spain, I think lots of countries, they use the full name, you know. And he was, and he's actually Jose de Jesus Guzman Garcia Jurado. So when I was sitting there and the girl says to me, what's the groom's name? And I looked at it and I said, well, actually, I'm not too sure. And my mother gave me an almighty dig in the ribs. I said, well, what? And she said, Eimear, please. So anyway,
Did any of your friends say to you, because we had, wasn't it Margaret Robertson who was on earlier in the week, and she met her chap fleetingly on a holiday, and her friends were saying, God, holiday romances. Now this one has holiday 40 years later. This they're still together. This holiday romances don't last. Was any of your friends saying to you, you're smitten by the exoticism of someone?
Not really. No, I don't think anyone really took me seriously. To be honest, I mean, they were happy enough for me, my friends. But it was my family, obviously, who were not. They were very, very concerned. And can you imagine? It's 1981. Mexico was the other side of the world at the time. I mean, it is, but it was a lot further away than it is now. I had my parents, and I can imagine, I now get it, if you know what I mean, because way back in the day, as I said, I was 20, I knew exactly what I was doing. But my mum has three amazing sisters, and they're more like sisters to me, because my mum's the eldest of a big family. So my three aunts and my mother and my grandmother sat me down one night, and I got the equivalent of an Irish intervention, and they did everything. They talked to me, they asked me questions, they put the whole worst case scenario.
The five women.
Yeah.
Your granny, your mother, and your three aunts.
Yeah. Yeah,
at the table, the star chamber. Yeah. And what did they ask you?
Well, I vaguely remember you don't know the first thing about him.
Yeah.
You don't know his family. You know, you've only been to Mexico once. You can't decide after 3 weeks living there that you want to spend the rest of your life there.
Okay.
Again, and what will you do if this happens, and what will you do when that happens? And there's nothing against
him. And how do you know he's not married to someone else?
That came up. Yeah.
How do you know he doesn't have children somewhere else?
Yeah, that came up because he's 5 years older than me. I was 21. I was going to be 21. He is 26.
And Eimear, what did they do? Did they have a vote at the end? They all held up a card at the end and gave you a vote.
Well, I think they did their very best to talk me out of it. I know that, and in the best sense, not in any
I know
bad
that.
Way,
I know I'm, that. I know that.
You know,
and did you cry during the interview with your five?
I don't think so. I don't. I remember the whole night has been very long because I went on till about 2 or 3 in the morning. And my grandfather actually came out looking for my grandmother. He wasn't impressed. And he gave out to my aunt for keeping her up so late.
So your granny is Judge Judy and the mother. So they're all. And did they come to a conclusion at the end? Did they say, well, did they consult with each other and then say, listen, look at her, she's mad about him and he's mad about her?
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't have. They said it to me if anybody could sit through that and you know, and survive and still want to go ahead and go for it.
Okay.
You know, what could they do? And they wouldn't have done anything. I mean, they're amazing. And and my grandmother was the best granny anybody could ever have had.
So the wedding was here in Ireland?
It was in
Ireland. Where did you live?
Well, we got married here and then we went, he was in Washington, D.C. then studying. So we had 9 months, roughly 9-10 months in the United States to sort of get to know each other properly, you know. And I started taking Spanish lessons and then we went to live in Mexico. And I love Mexico and his family are fantastic. And I was really, really, really happy in Mexico, you know.
And how long did you live in Mexico for?
For about 25 or 26 years. Yeah, no, it's a fantastic country and they're ourselves.
Eamon, can I ask you one question, which your granny probably asked. How can you be so sure, after so little time together, that you want to spend the rest of your life with him? And you're so young.
I had a feeling. I just had a feeling. I just knew it. And I know it's bizarre, and I now get it. My mother said to me, when you have a daughter of your own at 20, you know exactly what I mean now. And I did when it happened, yeah. I did get it, but I just knew. I just knew, Joe. And I think probably meeting the family and everything else had helped as well, because I had I'm fairly good at judging people. And I'm very determined, but I knew that's what I wanted. So
bring us up to Ireland 2021. Two questions. One, the boyfriend that you dumped back in the day.
Yeah.
Where is he?
I have no idea. I have no idea, Joe. Okay. No one, unlike your previous...
where is Hazu? Where's your husband?
Oh, over here. We're both here in Ireland. We came back.
Oh, you're living here now.
Oh, we're back in Ireland, yeah. We're back in Ireland. We came back. We've been talking about it for years and years, and then a couple of things came together, and we decided to go for it because our youngest was still young enough to bring him back, if you know what I mean. So we're back now, and we'll be 40 years in May, 40 years together.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, but I'm also thinking that Hazu, like he hadn't come to Ireland. It wasn't that he met you in Ireland. He'd never been to Ireland before he landed up at your father's doorstep and said, "My name is Jesus. I've come for Emer."
Yeah, he came to see me. Yeah.
And how's he settled into Ireland now after so
That's
many
fine.
Years?
It wasn't easy at the beginning, the weather particularly, and you know, it is very different. But at the end of the day, no, he's happy, and you know, we've the children. We're very lucky, Joe, because the three of them are here.
Yeah, great.
Well, our middle girl's actually in Sweden, but the other two are here, and now we came over. We were 5 when we moved back, and we're now 13. Because they've all got their partners in life, and we've got 5 gorgeous grandchildren.
Oh, wow.
So we're lucky. I think my mother used to say to me, "I'd prefer to see you happy over in Mexico than up the road and miserable."
Absolutely,
you know.
Absolutely.
And then she went over as well, and when she met the family and saw, could visualize where I was physically, you know, because again, no internet, no none of that.
Yeah.
So it was. She went over and she was happy then.
Eamor, have you any idea? Explain to younger people how much was a phone call between Ireland and Mexico back in the day?
I can't remember how much, but it was a hell of a lot, Joe. Yeah. I mean, you know, I just basically paid my, not most of it, but probably a fair share of my salary in phone calls, because obviously I wasn't going to land my father with the phone bill, but it was expensive. We used to tape, do you remember the old-fashioned tapes, the Maxell, we decided this would be a good idea. So we used to send tape recordings to each other. Yeah, and you'd live for the postman, you know. You know the song, Mr. Postman.
Wait a minute, Mr. Postman.
Yeah,
okay. And Hazel is well settled down in Ireland.
Yes. No, he's well settled. I mean, I said, we're very lucky that they're here, and the grandchildren are here. And
incredible. Again, it's the age that you were so young before you're 24. You decided to marry him, as happens, and then around your 24th. And two, the number of previous occasions you've actually met, and three, the distance. I know people say it is the same distance geographically. Communications wise, it was completely different.
It was a long way away, but anyway, it's a great story.
Many more years of health and happiness to you and all the brood. I'm still wondering where that chap was. Hazel lands in Dublin, this gorgeous, I'm sure your other Irish chap was gorgeous, this gorgeous brown-eyed beard, tanned chap from Mexico, sounding exotic and with the accent and everything. And you're going out with this other chap. Do you want to tell me his first name, or is that, do you want to make up a first name? Michael Fintan. Okay, so there's Fintan doing his best to entertain Hazel, and then he realises, that's life.
Yeah, I felt bad about it, as you can imagine. I mean, I really did, but at the same time, I was miserable, and there was no point. I was utterly miserable, and I couldn't believe it, how miserable I was, you know. And it turned out, years later, I discovered that trip, he was supposed to come over here for 3 weeks. And when I was with Vinton, and Vinton was everywhere, he cut it short to a week, and he never specified to me at the time how long he was coming for. So he said he was only there for the week. Mm-hmm. So I only discovered that a few years later, actually. But there you go.
Great story. Great story. Health and happiness.
Thanks very much.
For many more years. That's Eamonn Doyle Guzman. Joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Barbara Doyle, again, a gang of 10-year-old boys. What happened, Barbara?
I was listening to that lovely lady there talking. My daughter last week met up with her two friends
at
Liffey Valley in Tesco's.
Yeah.
And they came down, they were social distance, they were sitting there, there's like benches there, Joe. And they were sitting there having a bit of lunch and a chat. And about a couple of minutes later, five to six young lads between 10 and 14 started to circle around them and were making comments. And one of her friends stood up. I remember she had a lovely hat and jacket because she'd been at the door with her dad. And he grabbed the drink and poured the drink all over. Then my own daughter got up and said, "Look, go away. Blah, blah," a bit, you know, a bit annoyed. And then they started with extremely lewd comments about my daughter's legs, about she had lovely shaped lips for a lovely man that he could do things for men.
Yeah.
And
you're saying these were 10 years of age, maybe 11, 12.
Absolutely no older. She only had talked, this had happened last week, and she only told me there the other night because she said to me, "I'm 19, ma'am, and I just cannot understand why they seem to think that they can do this and get away with this." So it was eventually my daughter said, "Look, if you don't move, I'm going to call the guards or I'll do something." And one of the young lads said, "Oh, yeah, and what you'll do and all this crap." So she said, "Well, I'll do something myself. I'll pull you off that bike or something to that effect."
Mm.
And with that, they kind of, they cycled off. But my daughter had gone into, you know, because the security around the Tesco's there.
Yeah.
And as they were going in to see where the security man was, these lads had cycled around again, and they seen two young girls, and they actually spit on the two young girls. In their faces.
So there's one gang around six or seven young lads, aged around 10, hanging around Liffey Valley.
All around Ipswich Valley, Tesco there and all,
And intimidating young women.
Intimidating young women and spitting at them and making a lewd. I mean, I'm 58 and I wouldn't. When she said, ma'am, I don't want to tell you what they said.
Okay.
And I said, well, okay, tell me. But so she told me. And I was absolutely, I was disgusted.
Okay.
It's just disgusting to think that your child is coming out with that sort of you know, filth, and you can't even sit there and have a cup of coffee in peace. So I feel sorry for that poor girl and her friend.
It was a horrible attack. But the
awful
element of the awful attack was another element was the fact that they were around 10 years of age, a gang of lads, gang of boys. They're not lads, they're boys, for God's sake. Okay, but primary school children. Thanks indeed, Barbara. Back on Monday, 1:45. Dave Gibson on sound, Maeve Mooney's the BCO. The series producer is Rebecca Meehan, and today's producer was Lisa Marie Berry, and Ray Darcy's next.